it's going.
Okay, let's get started. Welcome. Good to see a good crowd. I'll be speaking on imagination in the Christian life. This is the first of three talks tonight, and then two tomorrow on the theme of imagination. We wanted to make this a weekend, because a bunch of us have done thinking about imagination and feel that it's a very important piece of what we're doing here at Libri, and a piece of what is the work of God in the world. Tomorrow, the first talk is at 9:35. Creativity for All, Imagination and Vocation. That'll be by Sarah Chestnut. There'll be the lecture, tea break, discussion, lunch at noon, and then at 1:30. Ben is doing a lecture, Ben Kai's lecture on ambiguity in art, leaving room for the imagination. And so that'll be this weekend. Just to give you a heads up for next weekend, which will just be a Friday night, no events on Saturday. Len Cowan, who is a retired Episcopal rector, lives in Northboro, who is going to be lecturing on ancient future world transformations, the life and witness of the monastic city in Ireland. So it's interesting, actually, to look at the monastic idea today when there's a lot of discussion about it, and the discussion of how do we need a monastic form to hold on to Christian culture as the culture is going so radically secular. So it's a very current topic of a lot of discussion. So, on for tonight.
May I just suggest if people could move from the center so that as people arrive, there's people on the aisle here, if you have space in your rows so that others can.
Could mean less choreography as we go on. Yes, as long as no one gets pushed off the ends. We don't want anyone to get pushed off the end of a line. Okay, starting off here, I've got an outline, because it's always nice to know that the speaker has a plan. The human imagination is a wondrous gift, and it's very, very hard to get even a grip on it. And you can tell, you'll be able to tell by my difficulties tonight in terms of to be able to say what it is, but not be able to at all deal with its boundaries. But its specific form, your imagination, is your ability to form, and here again I'm starting with a quasi-definition. Imagination is your ability to form mental pictures, relationships, stories, sights, sounds, visions, ideas, and connections between all of these that were not there before you formed them in your mind. In other words, you formed something that wasn't there before. It's your mind's ability to reach beyond what's immediately before you, what's immediately in front of you, in space and time, beyond what's available to your senses at any one moment, and to reconstruct scenes you once saw, or construct worlds that you have never seen, but can only imagine. For example, a very crude and simple illustration is that none of you can right now see the front of our house, because you're inside the house, you're in the library. But all of you, I think, probably came in through the front door, so saw something, and probably even remember a little bit of what the front of the house looked like. So your memory of the front of this house that you have right now is accessible to you only because you've got an imagination, because your imagination is linked to your memory enough so that you can recall what the front of the house looks like, because you don't have the front of the house to look at now. That is what your imagination does for you in a very crude and simple way. as it connects to your memory. That's just one connection of your imagination, but it's crucial to actual memory. Stores pictures of what you've known before, but can't actually have before you right now. I'll just give you another couple of weird examples of the power of imagination and its power. As I start out here, a couple of strange ways imagination works. I wonder if you have ever been up at night doing some sort of task that wasn't all that exciting, like maybe doing your taxes or balancing your checkbook or something like this, and you start to nod off. And you say, I've got to keep going, but you can't. It's a losing game. You're going to fall asleep. But you've been unwise enough to leave a good novel on your bedside table. And you think, just before I go to sleep, I'm going to read a page or two. And maybe an hour later, you're just thinking, you're bargaining with yourself about maybe reading one more chapter. And something's happened to you in that hour. Obviously, psychologically, your attention is hugely focused on some fictitious story, maybe a useless story, maybe futile and vain and silly story, but nonetheless, it's gotten a hold of your imagination, and it's changed your pulse rate, it's changed your blood pressure, it's changed who knows whatever else physiologically, along with your state of mind, your state of consciousness. That is the power of your imagination. Connect with a story and somehow connect with your whole physiological makeup, not your whole physiological makeup, but change the picture of your concentration and your whole state of mind. Or, example two, what makes perfectly normal and otherwise sensible people give away millions of dollars to state lotteries? Only I'd be treading on some toes here probably, but only a fraction of the people who play the lottery ever win anything. In fact, the percentage is lower than the percentage of people who get struck by lightning. The percentage of people who win lotteries you're less likely than to get struck by lightning. And the total sum of what's paid back by all the winnings of the lotteries, by all the people who do collect, put all of them together, is less than half of what's taken in. So it's got to be just a major ripoff by just any way you can do the accounting. But what is the secret? Well, it's the story. It's the story of a few people who have gone from rags to riches, who've taken in millions, maybe multi-millions of dollars, and had their lives entirely changed, bought Cadillacs and quit their jobs. That's what most people do when they buy a Cadillac and quit their job. And actually, quite a few of them are in debt within 3 or 4 years, having ripped through the whole thing. And not to dwell on that side of it. But what's doing that is the power of the imagination to connect with stories, and you to connect with a story in your own mind that is attractive enough and that somehow feeds you enough that makes you basically throw away a lot of hard-earned cash and outweigh the economic sense you were born with. So much for my petty moralisms. But we are looking at the power of the imagination here. It does something to us that is weird, and I don't think it ranks high on the rationality side of things. I want to look at a scattered sort of scope of the imagination and the Christian life and how it can be better used in God's service. It's grounded deeply in who we are as creatures of God, made as images of God, what makes us human. And it's the source of immense power for good or for ill. It will be scattered because the imagination has both these specific functions of the sort that I've just tried to detail in my definition, but also it's very hard to find any aspect of human consciousness that isn't affected by our imagination. So in other words, your imagination permeates everything that you do and have and so on. So it's hard to say what isn't affected by it, even though there are more specific areas which are its main purview. So what is it? What is the imagination? George MacDonald, the great English writer who was such an inspiration to C.S. Lewis, wrote, "The imagination of man is made in the image of the imagination of God." And also saying that the human imagination is the reflex of creation. The reflex of creation. What he seemed to mean by that, as I've understood, he wrote a book called Imagination. The working of our imagination is our reflex response to God's creative diversity in the world, the amazing diversity and wonder of plant life, of animal life, of the sea and what happens under the sea, of geology, of mountains, of deserts, of the amazing diversity and wonder of the natural world that's just there for us to observe, there for us to run around in, and so forth. The vast imagination of the Creator is there, and this inspires us to respond to that with our imagination. With a sense of wonder, with a sense of wanting to paint a picture of it, or building things, or whatever it may be. One philosopher, Michael David Naugle, who actually studied here years ago, said that your imagination is as close as you can ever get to being able to create ex nihilo. Theology talks about God creating ex nihilo, out of nothing, into nothing. And he points out that's as close as we're going to get. The working of our imagination is as close as we're going to get to that. It's not out of nothing, really, but it is amazingly free from limitations, depending on how our imagination is working. We all have imaginations, but we don't necessarily all use them very much or use them well. And that would be part of the main theme of what I'm trying to get at tonight, and it will be in all our discussion this weekend. I'll just start with children. I remember the famous story of Mark Twain's Tom Sawyer having the terrible and laborious job of having to paint his aunt's long fence with whitewash on a very hot, stifling summer afternoon. He managed to ease the pain of doing this by convincing his friends that it was a great and wonderful privilege to whitewash a white picket fence. And so he, in a typical Tom Sawyer fashion, bartered with them for all their prized possessions for the privilege of being able to whitewash this fence. So he sat under a tree in the shade and watched his friends come one after the other, and he would bargain with each one, and finally the job got done. And it just describes him ending the afternoon with a heap of treasure. And I just wanted to reflect on his treasure after this afternoon's leisure, but all of his friends' hard work. It says, there was no lack of material. Boys happened along every little while. They came to jeer, but they remained to whitewash. By the time Ben fagged out, Johnny Miller bought in for a dead rat and a string to swing it with. And soon on and on, hour after hour, when the middle of the afternoon came, from being a poor, poverty-stricken boy in the morning, Tom was literally rolling in wealth. He had, besides things I have mentioned, 12 marbles, part of a Jew's harp, piece of a blue bottle glass to look through, a spool cannon, a key that wouldn't unlock anything, a fragment of chalk, a glass stopper of a decanter, a tin soldier, a couple of tadpoles, 6 firecrackers, a kitten with only one eye, a brass doorknob, a dog collar but no dog, the handle of a knife, 4 pieces of orange peel, and a dilapidated old window sash. If he hadn't run out of whitewash, he would have bankrupted every boy in the village. Now, think about Tom's wealth. Think about how much imagination it takes to consider it wealth. To consider it treasure. Think of the the exercise of imagination that enables him to see it as a treasure trove. Nothing was complete, a piece of this and a bust of that, most of it broken. Compare it to the modern equivalent of a suburban child today, who at Toys R Us or Child World, and in their acres of plastic in boxes, might find a rocket launcher with every rivet represented that's there on the original. It's an absolutely scale model. It shoots rockets that will stick to the refrigerator. Lights that flash and appropriate grinding noises, as long as there's a battery in it. Nothing is left to the imagination except size. Do you see what I'm saying? It's all there. Every rivet in the whole blasted thing is there in plastic. So if we're talking about imagination, Tom Sawyer has us beaten today totally. Has today's child, who grows up in a wealthy background in the American burbs, has this child completely beaten at the level of imagination. Most kids today would throw out his whole pile of treasure so fast you couldn't imagine how fast they would just throw it away if their parents hadn't thrown it away first. Shifting to adult experience. Without using our imaginations, we have very little contact with what's most important to us. To honor, to glory, to greatness, to goodness, to beauty. I love the words of the seraphim in Isaiah 6, in his vision of the temples. Isaiah sees God in the temple. The seraphim was saying, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." Notice what was said. It's not just the temple is full of glory, or God is full of glory. The whole earth is full of his glory. The whole creation has his fingerprints of glory on it. In this intense experience of the presence of God in the temple, he's talking about the whole earth, not just what's going on there in the temple. And as many people today, we look at the whole earth and we see just matter, or even dead matter. Or perhaps what really would matter is what part of that we could measure with calibrated instruments. That would be the part that really counts, the part of the world that really counts if we can measure it with calibrated instruments. There's a wonderful literary example of the imagination. I'd love to do a lecture just retelling this story of Dickens' Christmas Carol. Scrooge, at the beginning of the story, is pictured as virtually without imagination, as complete imaginative shutdown, except for being able to imagine having more or less money tomorrow than he had today, than he had yesterday. It was like, you can imagine the boy horses will wear, or people will put horses' blinkers on so they can't, they're kind of shy by things they don't see on the side. It's as if he had blinkers on that only enabled him to see just his bank account yesterday and today and what it might be tomorrow. Everything beyond this was a grievous invasion of his privacy and his precious time. Anybody who tried to draw him aside for this was getting in his way of it and using his precious time. It's a picture of human implosion, collapse of the imagination in on itself through just straightforward idolatry. This is what happens to idols. You make as God something that's much less than God, and it collapses your world around you. Left with, and this is something I've lectured on a lot here, no sense of other. No sense of other. Just sense of self and again, his bank account. But the whole story is really, what did these three ghosts do for him? And you've got to see, if you understand what he's saying, these three ghosts, in a sense, violently jump-started his imagination. And that's what they did. It was to go back to his past, to force him to see the present. It forced him to see a sense of other, forced his imagination out to see more than just his little blinkered world, and even into his future, which by this time he was very nervous about because he wasn't at all sure that whether in the experience of ghosts he was actually already possibly dead. And so the future was a big issue for him, and a great relief at the end when it turns out that he wasn't. But you have this rebooting of his imagination, and so expanding his world, enabling him to have empathy, totally unknown in the first few pages of the story, love, also unknown, and joy. You see this wonderfully coming together in the last page or so of this story. So again, I'm giving you, throwing out examples of how imagination works, which are very diverse and run in all sorts of directions. Story itself is an outworking of the imagination. One of the strong territories of imagination is the story. If we had only the present moment of consciousness, we could have no grasp on any story at all, because we would have only a frozen split second of awareness for a split second before we'd have another split second of split second awareness before we, and so on. But you'd have no elapse of time or no awareness of an elapse of time. But with the imagination, which can hold in your mind a whole sweep of a story, a whole sweep of perhaps human history, a whole sweep of somebody's whole life, let alone what happened to you this afternoon or how you got here this evening. You can hold together a whole life of George Washington or John Kennedy, or the whole story of Treasure Island or The Lord of the Rings, with all the victory, the fear, the defeat, the pain, the heroism. It can be all there, and you've got that because you have an imagination, and you can track through time and hold it together. Because of the leverage that stories have on our imagination, some people are very afraid of the imagination, because stories can don't always, but can shift people from being fairly disconnected to being very passionate. And when people get very passionate, that's a scary thing. Some people get very worried about that. There's a wonderful statement by George MacDonald addressing this very issue. Because, again, stories inspire both aspiration, I want to become like that, like this person or like that person, but also they inspire aversion. I don't want to be like that. I don't want to be like that at all. So the two very strong imaginative dynamics of change, of transformation. I've got a seat here, a couple of seats here. Which can get a hold of you with quite a lot of power. And George MacDonald says this. He says, "Seek not that your," he's obviously addressing anxiety about children. "Seek not that your sons and daughters should not see visions, should not dream dreams. Seek that they should see true visions, that they should dream noble dreams. Such outgoing of the imagination is one with aspiration, and will do more to elevate above what is low and vile than all the possible inculcations of morality." Now, that's an interesting reflection here. If the power of imagination is used to carry God's truth, it can bring a hunger for what is good and what is true, which is very powerful, which can be a motivator way beyond all sorts of intense and sincere lectures about morality. Even why this is true and why it's so important that it's true. You put it in a story and you put it in characters in the story, and you can engage someone's sense of motivation. And I think this is true of us. I mean, it's not an accident, for example, that, I don't know, what is it? Probably 70% of the Bible is narrative. 70% of the Bible is story. I don't know what the percentage is really, but somewhere around that. Stories can help us not just know the good, but to love the good enough to do the good. And this is something I'm not going to have time to develop, but I would if I had more time. That a lot of secular ethical theories begin and end with the problem of how do you determine what is good and what is evil, what is right and what is wrong in any particular choice, often giving you unanswerable quandary ethical problems, like who do you throw out of the lifeboat when such and such happens or something like this. But never get past how you actually arrive at right and wrong. The Bible is way ahead of that. It says you've got to know what is, decide what is right and wrong, and this is how we'll let you do it. But you've got to do what is right, not just know what's right. And you've got to more still, you've got to love the right. You've got to hunger and thirst for righteousness. And then you will, as a whole person, do the right, the good, and so forth, when you are motivated as a whole person to it. Not just because you jump through special hoops of moral reasoning invented by 20th century psychologists. So, true visions and noble dreams do a better job than lectures on morality, probably even better than sermons on morality. When did you last hear of a new moral principle that you'd never heard of before? Probably was a long time back, because we've heard the basic moral truths already. Does that mean we know everything we need to know about morality? Not at all. We need help, desperate help, oftentimes, getting a fresh angle on the same moral truths that we've known all along. How does it apply to us? How does it apply to me now? How did what was seen to be a good moral principle go wrong here? How did it work out in the complexity of a story? If I live this way, follow this moral principle, what will my life look like? What sort of person will I become? What sort of person will I become if I follow the opposite path and take a very different course of action? Stories will endure. They tell, as some have said, the real story of the things that matter, of character, courage, cowardice, love, hate, suffering, and glory. Statistics, for all their necessary accuracy, which we need statistics, but just don't do that. They're not designed to, and they can't possibly do that. And we need them, but they don't do the same job. Stories are not just out there in books, films, or ballads. Our own lives are stories of some sort or other, like it or not. We often have quite a lot of choice about the shaping of our own lives, the shaping of the story of our own lives, about how they will relate or not to the bigger story that God is unfolding. But we have no choice about whether our lives are a story or not. Our lives, we are making a story, whether we like it or not, of some sort. And that's part of the reason I think that the story has a certain fascination to us, because we know that we are actually making a story by the choices we make, by the track of our lives as we live along. Imagination in the Bible. This is shifting gears a bit. I've been thinking more a lot about what imagination does. On the surface of it, at first sight, you might think as you read the Bible that the Bible has a negative view of imagination. If you flip through a concordance, it has phrases like, the imagination of a man's heart is evil from his youth. Or, the peoples have imagined vain things. So it would make you think that maybe imagination is a dangerous thing in itself. The imagination is often seen as a self-deceptive distraction from God's reality in the service of evil, because it can fuel your vanity and your pride. It can build visions of yourself with all the illusions of grandeur that the mileage of your imagination can create. Fame, of accomplishment, of extraordinary recognition, or whatever it may be. The Blue Ribbon today seems to be celebrity. Of course, the danger of the imagination is that with it you can play God to a degree that is very possible and completely unrealistic, because you can have almost complete autonomous control over what you let pass through your imagination, through dreams that you can create for yourself, all without restraints. You don't need to be restrained by laws of gravity, by the police, by the fact that crazy actions often bring terrible consequences. You can brush those all aside and just imagine a world in which those things don't apply. that you can walk out 10th-floor windows and sail off to a mountainside with no airplane or wings or helicopter or anything. So you can do that in your imagination, which you obviously can't do in real life. But that's not to say that imagination is evil. It's only to say that it is like every other gift we possess, and that it can be used for good or for evil. It can be used responsibly or irresponsibly, used to distract us from God, or used to serve God. Follow good, evil, glory, or ruin. The Bible's use of imaginative language is something that I've always loved. And by imaginative language, I mean language that forces you to use your imagination to grapple with these words. It doesn't allow you a freedom unless you just zone out altogether and let the words go through your mind and out the other side. By that I mean the language of the Bible is very often very concrete, very sensual, very metaphorical. All sorts of literary forms, satire, different kinds of poetry, proverbs, songs, parables, questions, as well as narrative and propositional statements. But many of it very, very imaginatively loaded in terms of its impact on you. For example, language itself is never referred to as language in the Bible. It's almost always something like the tongue. It's the tongue. It's what you've got inside your head here, in your mouth. And the tongue of a treacherous man is not dangerous. It's like a razor, or it's smoother than butter. And death and life are in its power. But you see, if we deal with, see, the language that's what we're drawn into here is not abstracting on language or words, but very visual images, razors, butter, and the power of life and death. The Bible doesn't describe itself as the Bible in abstract terms very much, or if at all, but it is a light to your path, or it is sweet like honey. Job is a book about what theologians would call the problem of evil, but the book actually deals with death, bereavement, financial ruin, public scorn, boils, and the ongoing burden of obnoxious friends who came to help. That's what it's about. It's not an abstract discussion of the problem of evil and how, where the arguments are formed or where it goes. This is just very much concrete, real-life situations. The sluggard isn't just unreliable or unmotivated, but he's like smoke in the eyes of his master. Or even as the wife who embarrasses her husband is not described as being overcritical or unsupportive, damaging to his self-esteem, but she is like rottenness in his bones. Now you see, what's going on here is these descriptions are not aiming at any sort of abstract precision, but of making you understand each reality in a way that you can feel it at the same time as understanding it. It's an understanding that draws you in into experiencing it in some way, and experiencing it even at an emotional level, at an experiential level, at a memory level, as well as, along with, understanding the basic cognitive content of what's being taught. You see the same kind of thing in the New Testament. I have to go really lightly through here. Jesus' language is always imaginative, concrete, and sensual. By sensual, I don't mean sexual. I mean sensual to having to do with the senses. I flipped my Bible open once, and on the two pages revealed in my Bible in the New Testament, I found, and you'll know where it was, I found logs in your eye, houses falling down, sheep, wolves, trees bearing fruit, knocking on doors, and throwing pearls in front of pigs. All in two open pages of the Bible. Okay? Now, I'm getting here to one of my grievances. I know books of theology written by people who profoundly honor Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior, who do not have as many visual images in a whole book as there are in these two pages of Jesus' teaching. Something happened some slippage here. It's not that Jesus' words are lightweight or without content or for entertainment. No, they're packed with tremendous content and great power. But Jesus addressed the mind and the conscience through the imagination. And isn't content with just feeding on the top inch of our skull, as it were, with data, but wants us to understand these things as a whole person, to feel what these things are like. Of course, he famously uses parables in this direction. It seems that a parable, I often think of it in this way, can carry truth where abstract statements or commands couldn't carry it. It's rather like you can drive a car just so far and the road gets rough and you need a Jeep. So you get a Jeep and you can drive a Jeep just so far, and then even a Jeep can't go there. You've got to go on foot. And I think in this way, in difficult communication uphill into defiance and defensiveness, Jesus is using parables as the last step to make his way through defense systems that people have, barriers of understanding that people have that they've built up, and all sorts of ways to go around their distraction and their defense systems. Each one, as it starts out, can draw you in. A sower went out to sow, or two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. Or in a certain city there was a judge who neither feared God nor regarded man. Parables draw you in into your imagination into verbal pictures. Two very different men walking up the steps of the temple. What are they going to do? Are they going to fight when they get to the top of the steps? What are they going to do? They're totally different. The Pharisee and the tax collector are enemies. What are they going to do? Well, you have to follow the parable to figure it out. Even the Apostle Paul, whose language is much more abstract than other New Testament writers and speakers, uses marvelous metaphors, analogies, visual images to do with law, marriage, slavery, freedom, competitive sports, trees, branches, and so forth, as well as, majorly, examples from the Old Testament, narrative stories, people, characters from the Old Testament, all through Paul's writing. Imagination in action. The style of communication of the Bible needs to challenge our own communication. This is where I'm aiming at here, that we pick something up from this and say, hey, this really ought to affect how we at least aim at communicating with each other and into the world. How can we do better to help each other to see, to understand, to really take on God's truth in a deeper way than just some facts or some data or something like this. That's something that really enters into our lives. Here I'll start with the challenge of doing publicly stating our faith. And I'll start with theology. Theology is a dangerous task. It's a wonderful task, and I'm all for theology. I'm not at all against theology. I wouldn't dream of being against theology. But it's a dangerous task because it interprets ultimate reality at its most basic starting point. If we get it wrong there, it will compound the mistake because we've made the mistake at the beginning. Sort of like making a mistake at your release of a bowling ball. It's just this end of the alley. It won't make much difference, will it? Well, yes, at the other end of the bowling alley, your mistake here makes a hugely worse difference, bigger difference than it did at this end. So you make a mistake at the release end, and you've got a major problem at the other end. So also, in as we do theology, we make mistakes or mislead people, and we can do, I think, a lot of damage. I'll read famous bits of a famous paragraph or two by Chesterton in his book Orthodoxy, talking about the church's doing of theology. He steps in the middle of an argument here, which I can't reconstruct for you. But last and most important is exactly this, which explains what's so inexplicable to all modern critics of the history of Christianity. I mean, the monstrous wars about small points of theology, the earthquakes of emotion about a gesture or a word. It was only a matter of an inch, but an inch is everything when you're balancing. The church could not afford to swerve a hair's breadth on one set things if she was to continue her great and daring experiment with irregular equilibrium. Once let one idea become less powerful and some other idea will become too powerful. It was no flock of sheep the Christian shepherd was leading, but a herd of bulls and tigers, of terrible ideals and devouring doctrines, each one of them strong enough to turn to a false religion and lay waste the world. Remember that the church went in specifically for dangerous ideas. She was a lion tamer. The idea of birth through a Holy Spirit, the death of a divine being, of the forgiveness of sins, or the fulfillment of prophecies, are ideas which anyone can see need but a touch to turn them into something blasphemous or ferocious. It's enough to notice that if some small mistake were made in doctrine, huge blunders might be made in human happiness. A sentence phrased wrong about the nature of symbolism could have broken all the best statues in Europe. A slip in the definitions might stop all the dances, might wither all the Christmas trees, or break all the Easter eggs. Doctrines had to be defined within strict limits, even in order that man might enjoy general human liberties. The church had to be careful, if only that the world might be careless. This is the thrilling romance of orthodoxy. People have fallen into a foolish habit of speaking of orthodoxy as something heavy, humdrum, and safe. There never was anything so perilous or exciting as orthodoxy. It was sanity. And to be sane is more dramatic than to be mad. It was the equilibrium of a man behind madly rushing horses, seeming to stoop this way and sway that, yet in every attitude having the grace of statuary and the accuracy of arithmetic. The church in its early days went fierce and fast with any war horse, yet it was utterly unhistoric to say that she merely went mad along one idea, like vulgar fanaticism. She swerved to the left and the right so exactly as to avoid enormous obstacles. And he goes on, in a way that only Chesterton can go on. But you see what he's saying could it be that we've forgotten the drama of orthodoxy, of actual teaching, and the tremendous implications that come from teaching as it stands, or if it was twisted, if it was bent, how it could spin off and do great damage. And so therefore, people in the history of the church had taken it very seriously, even fairly precise wordings of different things. But we have too much forgotten the drama of our tradition, of our the substance of what we believe, forgetting perhaps that we are a lion tamer. I'll just give you an example of that. I'll just give you one example of someone who I think maybe may have forgotten that. This is a statement of sort of definition of God's love. Okay? When the goodness of God is exercised towards his rational creatures, it assumes that the higher character of love, and this love may again be distinguished according to the objects on which it terminates, in distinction from the goodness of God in general, it may be defined as that perfection of God by which he is eternally moved to self-communication. Now, does that move you? Doesn't that perfection of God by which he is eternally moved to self-communication? Well, the Bible doesn't try to define the love of God, but tells us that it is as much higher than our love as the heavens are above the earth. It tells that it's just like an old Jewish father running down the road to hug his rebellious son who's just come back after blowing half the family fortune and messing up his own life. It says the love of God is like a hen gathering her chicks, scattered fearful chicks under her wings. It says the love of God is like a shepherd who loves his sheep enough to die for them. And on. We could go again and again and again, get illustrations of where it's used to communicate the love of God, and particularly through the life and death of Jesus. Isn't there a danger that expressing God's truth in excessively abstract ways can encourage a distant faith? In other words, if we live on this kind of statement and on this, say, this is the real truth, is in these abstract realities, this is what's really true, we can have illustrations, fluffy illustrations like Jesus gives, but the real thing is in these abstract realities. I think that feeds a kind of a distant faith. Everything is in order, but God is at arm's length. I fear a chicken and egg relationship between dead orthodoxy and overly abstract language. Another example. This is from John Steinbeck. He's describing a fish here. The Mexican Sierra has 17 plus 15 plus 9 spines in the dorsal fin. These can easily be counted. But if the Sierra strikes hard on the line so that our hands are burned, if the fish sounds and nearly escapes and finally comes in over the rail, his color is pulsing and his tail beating the air, a whole new relational externality has come into being, an entity which is more than the sum of the fish plus the fisherman. The only way to count the spines on the Sierra unaffected by this second relational reality is to sit in a laboratory, open an evil-smelling jar, remove a stiff, colorless fish from the formalin solution, count the spines, and write the truth. There you have recorded a reality which cannot be assailed, probably the least important reality concerning either the fish or yourself. It is good to know what you are doing. The man with his pickled fish has set down one truth and recorded in his experience many lies. The fish is not that color, that texture, that dead, nor does he smell that way. Well, of course, I'm suggesting here that you think we can do to God what this guy does to the fish. I think it's perfectly possible to do to God what this guy does to the fish. To reduce God to some sort of, because we want precision, and precision can be good, and we reduce it, our description of him that we can relate to very technical kind of fine-tuned categories. Clyde Kilby complained, he's a literature professor from Wheaton from the previous generation, our efforts to keep the gospel pure and the way of salvation clear have led us almost exclusively to the expository, frontal, exegetical, functional, and prosaic. Now, all those things are good, but not if we're limited to that, and our whole relationship to God is dominated by a freedom from imagination. It's good to be concerned for safety. Safety is good, but it's not good to be concerned only for safety or safety of accuracy. I remember Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson, described the last sermon that he ever heard. And he vowed as he went out of the church, this is the last church service I'm ever going to attend. He was still a fairly young man, actually, but he was good to his word. And he pointed out that of all that the minister had said, he heard nothing in the whole sermon which indicated that the preacher had ever actually walked on the surface of this earth. It's not that that was a huge turning point in Emerson's life, but it certainly didn't get through much to him. You could think of comparing this to some of the really wonderful Christian communicators that we've known and that are there in Christian history, people like Augustine, Luther, Calvin, Spurgeon, Chesterton, C.S. Lewis, all who are masters of imaginative language, of concrete imagery, of illustration, of somehow getting into the life of the people who are listening and reading, somehow connecting to something in their experience, in their life, so that they are able to feel something and connect with the reality that they're struggling for. Lewis is one of the best examples, really, because over 50 years after his death, some of his writing is still the best place to go to connect Christian truth with our situation. Lots of wonderful people have happened since then, but it's amazing that he died in 1963, but still his writings are, and a lot of his writings written before that, well before that. I have a quote from Lewis, or had for years on my computer. Now I've memorized it and don't need it on my computer. But it goes like this: any fool can write learned language. The vernacular is the test. If you can't turn your faith into it, then you either don't understand it or you don't believe it. Now, that's really quite interesting and a great danger pointing out to, because I'm running learned language, I can afford to be abstract. I don't need to actually communicate to ordinary people because I'm a learned person writing learned language, and which is a learned and high thing to do. And Lewis is saying absolute rubbish. If anyone was a learned man, he was. He says if you can't turn your language into the vernacular, meaning ordinary people's language, and if you can't turn your faith into it, either you don't understand it yourself, that's why you can't turn it into ordinary person's language, or you don't really believe it. Worse still, you don't even really believe it. And so I think it's a profound challenge, and a wonderful challenge, because it's easy to take refuge in learned language. Particularly if the more education you've got, the greater the danger is that you may take refuge in learned language. let me quickly say, I'm not against learning. I'm not against theology. I'm not at all. And at the highest level. But it doesn't need to be out of reach, and so out of reach that it actually may be hurtful to people as they try and grasp it. Theology is necessary and a helpful discipline, and should and has and should continue to help to serve the church. But I think it can be improved a lot, both in its content, but also, in my point here, is in its imaginative use of language. There should never be a choice between imaginative language and the hard biblical theological study, the grammar, the language, the genre, the context, the historical background, the hermeneutics, all the different theological or biblical and literary disciplines one brings to bear in the study of to the study of the Bible and to the development of one's theology. None of that excludes the imagination, or should. But it's too easy to hide behind learned language so that theologians can write just as any professional person has a professional jargon. Many of you are professional people who have a jargon that you get used to writing to other people who are in your professional discipline. That's fair enough. But if we're serving the church, we've got to break outside of the coziness of that group of colleagues who are the few people who can understand our learned language and get down. And if it's worth doing, I think it's going to be worth hearing by the church. And not to take refuge in technical jargon. We need to be able to use abstractions. Abstractions are absolutely necessary. Paul uses abstractions. The word Trinity is an abstraction. I'm not against abstractions, but they can be used with concrete and imaginative language. I see, for example, N.T. Wright as someone who's writing at the very highest academic level, but who is very gifted and puts a lot of effort into trying to making his writing graspable by a lot of people. And he does. I don't always agree with him on everything, but that's a different point. But he's someone who's writing very learned language, very new, challenging ideas, and he's making an effort to communicate to not just to people like himself. Popular language. This gets a little bit trickier. In terms of toes to step on. But I've always felt that a particularly unimaginative kind of language, Christian language, is the Christian cliché. Clichés are used to say things that are so familiar to you that you don't really need to think about them as you say them or be involved in what you're saying. They are a way of putting the Christian mouth on automatic pilot, and it is safe and effortless. They also function as passwords, sort of a checklist to establish safety in relationships. You can listen to someone talk, and you can tell quickly, is he or she with us, questionable, or possibly not one of us, because different cliches are used, or our cliches are not used. There are not certain things that are cliches. Anything can be a cliche. Some of the worst cliches can be said with total sincerity, which are glorious to God. So there's nothing that is as a phrase I can say, okay, this is a cliche. Did you ever hear this? That was a cliche. No, it's in your attitude. It's in how you use it, how it functions in your life. Any words can be cliches. You can take the greatest truths of God and reduce them to a cliche, and so that they communicate something horrendously unlike what they're meant to communicate. It's our attitude to the words and phrases. Being at Labrie is no safeguard against cliches. We can have our own Labrie cliches if we're not careful. Dead easy to do. Again, Clyde Kilby again. A cliche is simplicity with the heart and mind removed. It's communication about God, whom you love with your heart, soul, mind, and strength, but that communication is just words that flow out of your mouth. But just words, when they are about God, are not innocent words. Because if they're just words, it's taking the name of God in vain. It's breaking the third commandment. Why is that? Because in vain means signifying nothing. It means empty. When we take God's name in vain, we take his significance away from him, we rob him of his glory, of his honor, and we trivialize him in the minds of any who may be hearing us. This profanes God's name, and so is, I would say, profanity. Just as using God's name in swearing is profanity, because using it in swearing is just using it for punctuation. And so you can't, when you're speaking, put in 5 exclamation points, so you swear to get the point across. And so it's using the name of God for punctuation. But the name of God is not used for punctuation without really limiting and trivializing who God is. I sometimes wonder when I hear, I'll just mention a couple of them here, the praise the Lord's, or the God told me to, or God the Lord put it in my heart to share with you, this kind of thing, how I sometimes sense the ring of automatic pilot. I'm not saying that anyone who says those things are making cliches, but it's just that I wonder sometimes when I hear those lines. It's certainly wrong, it's certainly not wrong to say those things at all. But sometimes a cliche can be, I'm thinking here particularly, God told me to do this, that, or the other thing. A cliche can be also what we call around here Christian overspeak. When someone says that God told them something, I often ask, how did he tell you? How did you hear it? And sometimes I get quite an interesting answer. But sometimes I get the answer, more usually, that this person had a warm spiritual feeling, hunch, or intuition. And so they say, God told me. That's what he or she interprets to mean, God told me to do this, having a warm spiritual feeling, hunch. I'm much more comfortable with talking about having a warm spiritual feeling, hunch, and intuition than I am of labeling that God told me something. Simply because in the Bible, when God speaks to someone, very often they're on the deck, face down, and they're afraid they're going to die. And the first thing God has to say is, fear not. And that's not usually what's going on when one has a warm spiritual feeling, hunch. So do you see what I'm saying? That the danger is that we use words that are really big and heavy words. They're really substantial words. And I do know someone that God has spoken to, and I really believe her. But that's not many people, I think, that I've met probably has God actually spoken to. in that way. And so I want to keep our language down to what actually is going on, because we do wonders to make other people feel bad because God doesn't speak to me. And they think that God is speaking to you all the time, when actually you're having wonderful, warm, spiritual hunches and intuitions all the time, which is wonderful. But it doesn't help other people if they're getting the impression that you're having a conversation like we could talk with each other. Also, cliches freeze familiarity. They take the name of God, they make the name of God sound small and trivial and static, when in fact God is vast, profound, and always new. This is a serious problem for us, I think, and particularly today. I've often thought of doing a lecture on this itself, but the Apostle Paul, when he took the Christian message into the Mediterranean world, took what was shockingly a new message into that world. Its newness was sometimes a problem for him, but sometimes it was an advantage to him. As people were fed up, particularly Gentiles, were fed up with old ideas and assumptions about truth, God, religion, or whatever. To most of the people we're up to speak to in the U.S. of A., they do not hear the Christian faith as a new message. Now, it may, the truth, the actual gospel may be a new message to them, but they don't think it is, and then what they hear is something very old. They feel it is an old religion that has seen its day in the sun and really should shuffle off and disappear and make room for fresh ideas. If this is the perception, what happens if our evangelism is catastrophically predictable to them, loaded with cliches that they've heard before? See, I think this costs us now in a way more than it has before. It costs us because people are aware of having, many people have been evangelized, or at least they think they have, enough to dismiss it. Now, our message is 2,000 years old, and that's something we can be absolutely not ashamed of, and this is one of the great strengths of the Christian faith, is its age and its traditions and where it's from. But our language needs to be fresh. Our language needs to be unpredictable. You look at Jesus' language, and it was ridiculously unpredictable. He's got everybody off balance all the way through the Gospels. Would that Christians were able to somehow work out ways of being less predictable in the way we present God's truth. We need to grow better at talking about our faith using non-religious language that people will also be able to understand. A huge issue today, I think. Then imagination in everyday life. Our imagination is not, as I've tried to say, not often some small corner of Christian experience and life. The simplest biblical teaching about the Christian life demands a great involvement of the imagination. Your imagination enables you to build fantasies, to create elves and unicorns, and make all sorts of make-believe worlds. But remember that that's not all your imagination can do. Your imagination can see and hear what does exist, which isn't pretend at all, but which is at the moment, which exists, but which is at the moment invisible or inaudible to you. You can't see justice, forgiveness, the future, or God. But it has nothing to do with pretending anything. With your imagination, you can grasp these ideas and this divine being, because you're able to grasp what is real. The Bible straightforwardly embraces this. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Hebrews 11:1. You can't have faith without imagination, because you can't see this God. You can't see. Faith is a relationship to someone you can't see. So you need to step in. Your imagination steps in and says, yes, this God is there. I think this is one of the reasons Jesus had us look up to children and respect children. Unless you become like children, you're never into the kingdom of God. Children have a much easier time taking seriously the reality and the truth of what they can't see than we do as adults. If they hear from a reliable source that something is true, even though they can't see it, children, by and large, have a much easier time grappling, getting a hold of that, taking it seriously, not questioning it. How can we participate in the sacraments seriously, which are a visible representation of an invisible reality, without imagination? Sacraments become nothing other than a few scraps of bread and a few drops of wine. How can we seriously believe that the church is the body of Christ if we just look around us on Sunday mornings with no imagination? How can you believe this huge truth that the church is the body of Christ, which is a central truth? Just do you derive that by just looking around you Sunday morning? I don't think so. You derive that by studying God's word and really, yes, this is true. This is true of these actual people. Because they are part of it, and they are part of this whole. One of the most, I think, imaginatively taxing things we're called to do is to love people in the way Jesus says to love people. Jesus told us that, and think of this as a challenge, as a direct challenge to your imagination. Jesus taught that as we treat the least of these my brethren, so we treat him. Now, this is to me a massive outreach. It means take the least, let's say, attractive or and apparently unimportant of God's people that you know of, and as you treat that person, so you're treating Jesus Christ. How would we treat Jesus Christ if he walked in this door here now? We would fall. I mean, if we knew who he was, we would worship him. We're not told to worship other Christians, but we're told to have massive respect and care for and attention to someone who's the least attractive, the least seemingly important person we have around. And that's a stretch. That's what Jesus is doing, to stretch your imagination way, way, way beyond where mine will go at the moment. But hey, that's what's happening. And that's what he's expecting. And this, to do this not just once on a Tuesday afternoon, but to do this as a life commitment. Or think of Hebrews 13:3. Remember those who are in prison, as though in prison with them. Those who are ill-treated, since you are also in the body. Again, the same idea. In the body. What body? In the body of Christ. This is a direct command to empathize. To put yourself in the shoes of the people in prison and the people who are being ill-treated. That's a command to do it. You're meant to do it. to project yourself into their shoes in order to love them, in order to care for them, in order to pray for them. They're your brothers and sisters and part of the body of Christ. That's a huge reaching out. That was the very thing actually Scrooge was not able to do. You remember one of some of the dialogues early in the Christmas Carol about let them go to prison, or let them if they're debtors and so forth, just with absolutely an absolute absence of empathy. We need the imagination to break out of our individualism, out of our selfishness, to reorient ourselves and our values to match those values of Jesus. And just think of the, again, I'm throwing some very heavy things out, but I don't think we usually get a hold of them and realize what sort of demand is actually made of us at a deep level. When Jesus says, the first will be last and the last will be first, that means in his accounting of the final judgment, the people who are the winners in our life, the winners according to all the scorekeepers of, let's say, the best-selling American magazines, will be actually at the bottom. And the people who will be at the top are the people whose names you don't know, who maybe you know a few of them. Maybe you are one of them. but they're not publicity. They're not. They haven't received publicity. Means we must let our allegiance go to today's scorekeepers and the whole value scheme of celebrity and the value of wealth, power, and celebrity, and say what God values is really those who are out of sight. Those who are, not that he doesn't value and know everybody, but what he values is the lifestyle and the reaction and the interaction of people who are out of the limelight and simply living in faith and in simplicity. And what would that mean to do that? Think of what it would mean to actually do that, to reprocess our imagination in that way. And I think the church has a huge amount to repent of here. I think I've been in many Christian organizations or occasions where someone does something very successful in the eyes of the world, and then they lift it up in the church because now we've really made it, because they've scored in some very high visibility achievement recognized by everybody. That's great, but I think it's really a mistake to lift up the Christian who's somehow made it in the world's eyes, as if making it in the world's eyes was where it was at. Oh, bring this together now. The Christian imagination is a sleeping giant, a great force, only partially tapped in our generation. Flannery O'Connor wrote that she was often asked the question, doesn't your faith, with all its doctrines and principles, constrict and hinder your freedom as a writer? And she said, absolutely not. But the main effect of the faith on a writer was in guaranteeing his respect for mystery. That was what the Christian faith ought to do for any writer, is to guarantee their respect for mystery. Not to inhibit them, not to sort of box them in somehow. And that's not all that could be said, but what would happen with Christians writing. So, we need imaginative Christians to do theology, to do evangelism, to be pastors, to write books of all sorts, to make films, to make music, to tell stories, to do science, to work in government, to work in industry, education, every other conceivable discipline you can imagine, to be there with their imagination flourishing, because the Christian imagination will reflect the glory of God into this world. Remember the words of the seraphim in the temple, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And the question is, do we see it? Do we contribute to it? Are we part of it? And I will stop there. And as we do always on these Friday nights, throw it open for discussion. And the discussion will go on for as long as anyone wants to talk. So that means when you have to go, just go ahead and leave. Don't think you're bothering us if you get up and leave. Because that's what happens every Friday night. So just going to rearrange this for a minute, and then over to you all. Anyone want to start off? Yes.
Good evening, Dick.
Good evening.
You gave us a lot of things to think about. I guess some of us may be back here tomorrow thinking some more about these things. But something came to my mind, which is from the works of C.S. Lewis, and since you started off talking about him, maybe that's a way to start the discussion here. You spoke about the use of cliches and how we use cliches and don't mean by them what the full meaning of those words are. Do you recall in the book called That Hideous Strength, which is the third of the Space Trilogy, when the protagonist Elwyn Ransom encounters the ancient British magician Merlin? You remember that?
Vaguely, yeah.
Okay, so Merlin has been in some kind of stasis for 1,000 years, and he's brought back for this episode. And he meets the Elwyn Ransom, who's the protagonist. And Merlin asks Ransom some very pointed questions. They don't know each other. Merlin comes in to where Ransom is, asks him very pointed questions. and Ransom answers him, and the answers that Ransom gives him are based on things that happened to him, and are things that had previously happened to him, in mostly in the previous two books of the trilogy. If you haven't read it, it's great. You should read the trilogy. But so at any rate, after asking these questions and receiving Ransom's answers, Merlin begins to treat Ransom with a great deal of respect. So obviously Merlin is very satisfied with the answers that Ransom gave. So they speak on some more. And by the way, they're speaking in Latin, because that was the language that Merlin spoke, and Ransom is enough of a language expert to speak it fluently himself. So they're speaking in Latin, but they sort of get at cross purposes. And they're not understanding each other, and they'll, wait, huh? And then after some misunderstandings and obvious confusion, Merlin backs up and says, wait, when I came in, I asked you these questions, and you gave the answers which show that we are members of the same order. But you don't seem to be speaking as a member of my order. And Ransom says, I gave you those answers not knowing that they were the password of the order. I did not know that. I answered the way I did because I gave you true answers. I gave you the true answers because those were true. And so then Merlin is even more startled, realizing that Ransom has a special job that even Merlin foretold. So, I won't spoil the whole story for you, but it's an amazing thing where Merlin is saying basically passwords and expecting the password answer. And Ransom is giving him the true story based on his experience on different planets of the solar system. Mm. And so Merlin's expecting cliche, and he's getting eternal fixed truth full of meaning and not even realizing.
Well, that's
and then when he finally realizes it is, he's just shocked. And he just basically wails, this is bigger than I thought. All right.
Well,
so that's what it was.
Would that all cliches would function that way? That would be nice.
All right.
Yes, any other? Yeah, Jeff.
One of the stories that you sometimes read to students is the life of Walter Mitty. And it's someone who has a very vivid imagination, but uses it to escape. I guess I'm wondering, what would a redeemed imagination look like for someone like him?
For someone like him? I'm not sure I could rewrite it for you. But I think you put your finger on in terms of the escapism of how it functions. Actually, his imaginative escape contributes to his utter incompetence in the this world events that he screws up each time. Is anyone people familiar with The Secret Life of Walter Mitty? Good. Well, it's worth reading. It's very short, only about 6 or 8 pages. But it's a fascinating thing by James Thurber. Nothing to do with the movie that's out, on as far as I can tell, or very little to do with it. But it's a classic thing on self-delusion of yourself in massively heroic roles. Which is, the minute he relaxes for a minute, he sees himself in some heroic role, and then something happens to him before he's waking up, and he's messing up the situation. He's forgotten to get his wife's overshoes, or he's forgotten to he can't park his car properly, or whatever it is. It's just very mundane things that he fails at because he's so preoccupied in his spaced out, very vanity driven world. Of him being a famous person rescuing a friend of Roosevelt in an operating room and so forth. This is to do an adequate answer, I would want to do a lot more than I have time for tonight, but we need to redeem the imagination and our imagination and in our vision of what we want to become ourselves. If our whole picture of what we want to become ourselves is completely unrealistic, out beyond the farthest reaches, and just the to be some high-flying celebrity or something like this, which has nothing to do with who I can actually become, as in his case, then our imagination trips us up and destroys us all the time. I have argued at great length that the basic imaginative trajectory we need to have needs to be controlled by the imitation of Christ. In other words, he is the hero with a capital H, who is the one who, because he is the one who shows actual human excellence. And not that we can become divine, but because he's given us about half a dozen things for us to imitate in him, to do to each other as he has done them to us. They're to do with humility, love, service, suffering unjustly, forgiveness, and courage. Maybe there's one other, I can't remember. But these are things that we're told to do as he did them to us, or whatever it is. Now that, a redeemed imagination will have those things as the central things to which we aspire. And those will not lead you to utterly unrealistic expectations, which just bring you crashing down in shame each time. Because each time he comes crashing down in shame because he's exposed and being a klutz and being so far from his heroic world. These things are real. These things are actually accessible, unlike most modern heroism, which comes from Hollywood and is no one can live it can live it out, and so it just makes us feel it no longer stretches us toward being more than we were, but it makes us feel disgusted with ourselves and just focus on how ugly and dull we are by comparison to Hollywood. So I think there's a huge amount to be said to rethink what heroism means, rethink what excellence is. And I think I often use him as an example of exactly the wrong way to go, because heroes his heroes are his tyrants. He can never become anything like any one of them. They just reduce him to klutziness whenever he lets himself get into them. And whereas with Christ, it's exactly the other way around. The heroism of being like Jesus is actually, in a limited way, accessible. I mean, growing in humility is possible. Growing in love, growing in service, growing in ability to forgive is all somehow accessible in a way like being a fantastic athlete, a rock star, a movie star, whatever, is not going to be accessible to us. Or a Nobel Prize winner for whatever comes up. Is going to just be out of sight, whereas the true human excellence is in Christ-likeness, and it is in a limited form accessible to us, and so will not crush us in the way his heroes crushed him, and nor will it, as we grow in any one of those areas, it will make us more deeply human. Rather than if we try and imitate some movie star or somebody else whose gifts we can't possibly imitate. We're not imitating Jesus' gifts, we're imitating his character as it lived out in his life, which is accessible to us. So that's sort of a long way around, but it's a very, very, very different perspective on how our imagination connects with our lives. Because that's why, if we have a sense of the heroic grounded in Christ, it will make us more able to obey what is Christ-like, more wanting to do what we know to do is right, because our imagination and our sense of the heroic will be driving us to do it rather than working in a different direction. So, yeah.
I just want to thank the young man for your questions. That was something I had. And the life of Walter Mitty made me think of the old song by Smokey Robinson in the Miracles. With my imagination running away with me, and I'm saying idea. But I remember seminary meeting with the spiritual director for the first time and thinking my imagination was bad and evil because it did run away with me and it did lead me to impure thoughts and unhealthy thoughts. She directed me to use it in a redeeming fashion, and she said if it helps you produce fruit of spirit, then it's redeemed. Then it's good and healthy. So that's a, maybe a way to look at it. The fruit of the spirit, if your checklist, if your imagination is helping you produce love and joy and peace and hope. So.
A word on that. Again, the other side is the negative. I think the Bible also has helped, gives us a wonderful picture of what is real human excellence and what we ought to build our imagination around, which is Christlikeness. But it also helps us get rid of the wrong heroes that are really destructive to us by, this is my own take anyway, the biblical doctrine of the fool. The Bible doesn't say, don't have the wrong heroes, don't just chase Hollywood or something. It gives you pictures of these heroes as losers and jerks. In other words, it addresses your imagination. It doesn't tell you, naughty, naughty, you shouldn't have the wrong heroes. Stop it. But it tells you, gives you pictures of the fool who is really a jerk. Again and again, all sorts of different fools who are fools because of their arrogance, fools because of their self-preoccupation, whatever it may be. But it connects with your imagination directly, which is where the action is, rather than lecturing you morally or something like this. So you think of the hero investment capital who is told, you know, well, tonight your soul is required. You're going to die tonight. On absolutely everything that matters, you are absolutely broke. You know, this guy, this hero is investment capital. You're totally broke in anything that matters at all to you right now. And so he's a loser. And so the Bible, I don't want to get into the whole thing, but there's a lot to be said for what the Bible does to help you unload, house clean, the heroes that shouldn't be there. And there are all sorts of things like Walter Mitty's cast.
So on the other end of the spectrum, which I think is a lot more common for this generation, the lack of a strong imagination, in lieu of trios of nativity ghosts, how should a Christian go about like growing a strong imagination? And I mean like very practically speaking. Do you know of examples from Christian history, specific scripture? Because that's not like there doesn't seem to be a lot of teaching. Like how would someone go about creating that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think reading good literature is a huge thing. Reading the Bible itself with eyes opened as to the importance of imagination. I mean, there's this absolutely limitless places to turn and sources of inspiration. George MacDonald said, how do you teach a child imagination to grow? And he says, turn your kid out in the natural world, leave him alone for a while. Doesn't mean abandon your child, but let your child play in mud puddles. Let your child just hang out and make his or her own games or things in the natural world. The natural world he saw as a huge place to let your imagination be fed. The British philosopher, I came across this just this week, Stuart Hampshire. Some of you may have read some of his things, but he talked about the imagination is a bit like a compost pile because it's invigorated by you keep adding more stuff to it and it keeps and you turn it over and it keeps developing and growing. So think of what sort of a compost pile you can create. But what he means is experience, is human experience taken in and thought about, reflected on, and lived out, but you can, of course, decide a lot what imaginative literature, film, so on, music you're going to take in. And so it's not just taking everything, because you're smart enough to know what you can take in which is going to help you in a good direction and what isn't. I think literature is a great area, but again, read the Bible with this in mind, to let your imagination be informed, to let it grow, to let yourself out, to, well, being and appreciating the natural world. That's something you've done a bit of anyway, but that's a great thing to do. That's a part of what we're called to do. And I think discussing with others who are imaginative people and dealing with it, I find we have some discussions around here with people very interested in literature and making and all sorts of imaginative arts, and it's hugely stimulating and helpful to find out what other people are doing and what moves them. But I don't see a how-to here, and it's something we all are doing, and it's, I mean, we can't all have ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future come and take us for rides. Unfortunately, we don't need it, all of us. But
I've heard very often what you were saying of a small child kind of somehow intuitively knowing how to be creative and imaginative if you just let them do it. And I find that
well,
very
in the natural world.
Yeah.
McDonald's talking about he's assuming the natural world rather than just a concrete and plastic cubicle.
And what I'm wondering is, do you understand why that changes at some point? Well, like sometimes, like there's some point in our development that we tend to, at least maybe in our generation especially, lose that. Do you understand why that happens? I feel like if I understood why that happened, it might help me figure out how to kind of find that again.
I'm not sure we lose that ability, because I think lots of people are tremendously stimulated by the natural world, even as people who are as old as I am. But as we get a bit older, we also need interpersonal interaction all the time from the very, very beginning. But I think our interpersonal interaction becomes a hugely important thing. And McDonald wasn't suggesting that you can rely on the natural world, that's all at any age that you need to do, but just to start there and to let someone's imagination just roam and find out what's fun to play with and how it works. But I'm not sure there's any age limit on this. I mean, I think of all sorts of people who have that same fascination, in a sense, a very fresh fascination with the glory of the natural world, the created world, on into later in life. But I think he was just trying to say, maybe speaking into a Victorian era of maybe over control of young kids, let them go out and play in the grass for a while, or let them play in the mud puddle, or play with animals and just see more of the world. Yeah, so I'm not sure I
couldn't ask that very well. I think I was reading Richard Foster today on the spiritual discipline, and he was just pointing out how so often to become more imaginative, which helps in, say, like meditation, like a spiritual meditation, so often we have to turn kind of to children and be like, yeah, what are they doing that we are not doing anymore? For some reason, children, if taken off bed, they do kind of naturally seem to be doing what you're talking about, versus all the time, in my age group, it doesn't seem to naturally happen. And so that's what I was, you rather definitely find people that do it, and that's awesome. But I guess for those of us that maybe did seem to lose some of that, just wondering why we did and how to rectify the situation.
I'm not sure I can help you on that. Yeah, did you have something?
When you used the word orthodoxy earlier, another word that came to mind right behind that one was heresy. And it maybe isn't too much of a stretch to think of heresy as an active imagination applied to, you know, some of the rudiments of the Christian faith. And if that's true, then it would tend to imply that there's some care that has to be taken with imagination, either in how it's applied or there is some limit that ought to be associated with it. And just sitting here thinking about that, it actually has made me slightly friendlier sort of in spirit towards the heretic, in the sense that, you know, it's always been nothing but sort of bad, in the way that I've sort of been trained and acculturated inside of the Christian community. Mm-hmm. But so, first of all, I just wonder if that's mm-hmm. a good way to think about it, that it is that it is imagination applied, maybe particularly energetically, to some of the rudiments of the Christian faith, but also then there's something in that which is either a cautionary note or some suggestion that the imagination, there are pathways where it is more appropriately channeled and other pathways where maybe less so. Yeah. So that's, I'm just sort of stirring all that.
Sure. I don't want to encourage your attraction to heresy. I mentioned it in a couple of places, but not maybe enough. But imagination can be to the good and to the bad. It's hugely powerful to evil if it's allowed to go there. And so unrestrained is totally dangerous, and there's nothing good to be said for it, because you have the huge human creativity that's grinding off, driven by your own autonomy, your own need to be independent, your own need to be to push God out of the world, or whatever it may be. Edmund Burke invented the term moral imagination, the great 18th century parliamentarian in England, and he invented that term in response to his horror of the French Revolution. And Rousseau's imagination let loose autonomously and built on an idea of human goodness, and look what happens. You have an absolute bloodbath in a whole country. And Burke talks about the need to build a moral imagination that will, not just moral principles that would limit this, but he was aware that we need a whole imaginative picture to guide people toward the right political choices, the right political vision to have that would guide them. And that totally means there are boundaries, there are guidelines that we've got to stay within that respect God's truth. So I would hold there are biblical guidelines that will help us guide our imagination and will limit the freedom of our imagination, that we not do enormous amounts of damage to ourselves and others through it by letting it roll. And there's all kinds of examples of that going around. So I think that's and a lot of heresy has been developed in that way. Not all is imaginatively spun up, but a lot of it is, especially through, say, the Romantic movement or something like this. But it's sometimes it's more rationalism or whatever. I think it's we definitely need to be aware of there being boundaries to it that are framed by God's truth that we need to really stand. And otherwise, we've got a very, very powerful thing that's going to do damage. Yeah, sorry. Yes. I'm trying to be quicker on the questions.
I want to say some things to Carly Kirkrow. You had a great question. I think that's something I really have struggled with for years. And it was because I love imagination so much. It's one of my favorite. And I lost so much of it when I was 16 and on. It was so much because I got super consumed with reality. I got super consumed with figuring everything out, making sure the doctor was correct or this was correct, and making sure everything was in line, and making sure that I was doing things well. And I think that I lost the ability to let go a little bit. You know, and so something I've been trying to regain the last years has been not having to have concrete answers and being okay with the fact that I don't know everything, and being okay that maybe it is okay that
coming to heaven, I'm like, okay, cool, that was, didn't get that one, you know, like, I have no idea, you know, but just allowing it to be more of letting the imagination stir, and it's like, yeah, it's totally sanctified, it's something that's going to be, like, God's bigger than me, so I don't have to fear that I'm going to fall apart just by letting my imagination go to fairyland, you know, it's like, and so just taking away the fear from it, and knowing that you have a Holy Spirit in you that's not, it's not going to just let you fall off. You know, like, yeah, not being so afraid of it. And just, like, taking the walk, doing the silly things, like, making up the story.
Yeah, yes, Cody.
Yeah, I just wonder if you or anybody else sees a difference between a mature imagination and maybe a childlike imagination. Because there seems to be something much different between, you know, Tom Sawyer seeing treasure in a rat, a dead rat in the street, and a poet or a novelist.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that what they do? Isn't that what a poet and a novelist does?
Does.
You see the value of the dead rat.
Mm-hmm. Well, the novelist wrote about it.
No, seriously.
I think. Obviously, there's a huge difference. The question is how we could track that difference and see any continuity between them. I think imputing seeing value to something that doesn't have any apparent value, or seeing purpose, something doesn't have apparent value or purpose to it, but that can have purpose that I put on it as I would use it or as I would value it, is something that goes all the way up into our mature imagination. Now, obviously, a busted piece of glass or a dead rat with a string to swing it on isn't going to have the same impact on an adult. But it is somehow to even with poetry and the value put on words to do much more than that word will literally do as it stands in its dictionary definition is related, I think. I don't know, did you have a particular angle?
No,
that
was just a question.
Yeah.
I think I have a partial answer. There are some very creative people who get lots of credit for great ideas, and they just say, you don't realize how many bad ideas are thrown away. You know, that maybe an adult would look at the dead rat, and, you know, who knows where imagination is going. Maybe they're dissecting it. Maybe it, you know, just it might take it further than just the surface, or, you know, a broken piece of glass can lead to, who knows, physics discoveries about diffraction and lenses, and it just maybe you can just take it further and cast away lots of the initial surface ideas that occur but don't seem to go anywhere. I don't know. That helps.
Right? Sarah?
I've been thinking, as we talked about this, about the place of enjoyment in nurturing imagination, and even to your point, Anna, I think losing the ability to enjoy things is also deeply connected to our imagination. And so, you know, I think like with enjoyment is curiosity and play and nurturing delight in things and expecting to see goodness in them. And I think that's something that like we do kind of have to fight for that as we get older because of increased responsibilities and time constraint. And you know, like I think it's not. I don't actually feel like my imagination is fed by playing with my kids very often. Like I wish that were the case, but it usually feels like you're taking all of my energy and I don't have it anything left. Like, there's no imagination left. I do think as we grow, our imaginations are fed by different things too, and I don't know, like,
That's the end of
that.
Peter,
that. Yes. I would actually say that you can argue that our imaginations should be driven by application, knowledge, and wonder. Application, if you look at what Jesus Christ said when his parents found him in the temple, he said, "I must be about my Father's business." And as you pointed out in your lecture, Christ was very imaginative in how he was about his Father's business. Mm-hmm. So how do I actually achieve my Father's goals in my life? Mm-hmm. Just application, right? And with the knowledge, if you look at Gideon and Gideon's conquest, once he was given the commission by God and his people whittled down to but a few, how was he going to conquer the enemy? He had to know the enemy. He had to know how people think. Mm-hmm. He had to know what God wanted to do. He had to know the abilities that God had, that they were limitless. So you have the application of knowledge, and you have the wonder about what is around you, about God's creation, about your gaps in knowledge, and how do you make up those gaps in knowledge. God tells us to look at his creation, he says, to testify to him. And he even says that we can see his eternal power and Godhead in his creation. Mm-hmm. So if we have the application that was driven by the Lord, if we have the knowledge of the Lord and all of our surroundings, if we have the wondering, even when looking at the piece of glass to discover refraction, then that will help hone what our thoughts are, that will help keep our thoughts targeted and pure, and that will frame exactly how we proceed in this world of imagination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think of what you... such as the whole worldview of the Bible is going to help us in this.
Yes.
In terms of what we know, how we're to live, and is wanting us to thrive and wanting us to expand and give glory to the God who made it all. And so all of these pieces are going to work together and feed each other, I think. Yeah, let me just see if the
idea. Yeah.
I had some other hands over here. Someone in the corner. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I thought you spoke about Christian oversee. I really appreciate what you said. And I think there's an interesting interplay between imagination and being in the present without imagination. You know, for example, it takes imagination to say that warm, fuzzy feeling, God spoke to me.
Mm-hmm.
That's imagination.
Yeah.
And then when I communicate that to somebody else, I harm them because in their imagination, I really did hear from God.
Mm-hmm.
So you, and in fact, you said you appreciated someone being precise with what happened, not elaborating, just saying it was a warm spiritual feeling.
Yeah.
And I see an interplay between being in the present and speaking the present and not elaborating or not blowing it up and just imagining it to something that it isn't. And that leads me to, like, there's a exercise that when some writers have writer's block, they don't seem to have an imagination, sometimes there's an exercise where you just start describing the smallest possible thing, like the brick in the corner of a building, and writing about that brick and how it relates to the next brick, and expanding out, you know, rather than trying to, like, write an essay on LaBrie, you know, to pick some small thing and try to find accurate words to describe exactly that small thing. And that somehow leads to imagination.
Mm-hmm. Good. I don't know. I've never had real writer's block. I don't think so. But on your first thing, I think you're right that your imagination, with all the good intentions you may have, can mislead people. You know, if you just spin out your imagination and let it go, you can really mislead people, misguide them, and do harm as you tell them your own story. You know? And you can exaggerate it. You can tell it. You can think more is involved in it than it really was, and be unhelpful. So, I think we have to. Again, there's all sorts of ways we have to hem in our imagination, because it can go all over the place. And we have to hear to know ourselves. What are the occupational hazards of being you, and having your imagination? There'll be particular ones that aren't the same as anybody else's. But they'll be real. Where is it? Is your imagination apt to be a problem to spin out? And what? Maybe to get very, very discouraged. Very easily. Something happens, and negative clouds come in. Huge imaginative constructions of disasters that are sure to happen. For somebody else, it may be just the opposite. That you, you have a terrible trouble seeing any dark clouds anywhere in the world, and just always put some naive and optimistic spin on whatever catastrophe is going on. That may be the occupational hazard that we need to know ourselves somehow. And I often think of David as he goes to the army, the King David in the army before he was king, and hears Goliath mouthing off. The whole Jewish army was terrified and ran. He was the only person whose imagination had room for, no, I can't kill him. No, I'm going to. But nobody else, it didn't occur to anybody that there was anything other than complete disaster from this giant up there. And that's weird. Maybe it's not too weird. Everyone's scared to death. And maybe it was God especially who gave him this vision. But how we perceive a crisis will be a very individual thing in terms of how your imagination reacts to crisis or crises. We ought to know how we tend to respond to crises, because it will help to either to lean one way or the other or whatever. Because we're very different from each other. I mean, some people love a crisis and never had it so good, and they're stimulated by it. And others just pack it in, give up, throw in the towel. So fear, hope, both are very much interacting with imagination. Yeah, any other? Yes. Yeah.
So thank you very much for this. It's very, I think it draws us in directions that we don't spend enough time working with. But thinking about, you've mentioned Storyhearst several times. I am really working through thinking a lot more about the big story of the Bible, the big narrative. And I was just wondering, when we're talking about story here, could you comment on how imagination relates to recognizing the big story of the Bible, to interacting with it, to placing yourself in it, to communicating it, or even is there a big story of the Bible? You might not agree there is a big story of the Bible, so you could comment on any of that.
No, I certainly is a big story, and I think. One of the things faith does for us is to link us to that story, so that you're not just a little person alone dangling somehow by a string in solitude, but you're the flow of your life through time is part of a much larger story that's happening, of which you are a part. It's not separate from you, but in a way, the reality of faith is to be able to see yourself as part of the story of God, see yourself as part of the big picture. I often think of it as if we were one wire in a cable. A cable which goes from past to future, which is the work of God unfolding in the world. And we, along with everybody else who's a believer, is like one wire as part of that, who has a role to play in terms of the overall strength of that cable, in terms of what that cable is able to do and how it's to function. Now, a cable is a one-dimensional thing, so it's a very poor illustration, really, because what we do as part of God's story is multidimensional and reaches out and touches all sorts of people's lives and all sorts of different ways that we, some of which we know and some of which we don't know. And so I think the quest for meaning in life is resolved in my participation in the big story. And it's not separate from the big story. It's not to be ignored by, but it's very much part of that big story. And its meaning is carried by the meaning of that big story, which is the ultimate meaning of the universe. So the ultimate meaning of what exists is in that cable, is in that big story. And yet we, Wonder of Wonders, are a meaningful piece of that, much more so than one wire lost in the middle of a cable. But as Jesus says, you know, you are more, he knows how many hairs you've got in your head, he's keeping track of you, you're of more value than many sparrows, and so forth. He knows exactly who you are, what you're thinking, what you're doing, what you're facing, and tracks on you every day, all day, every day, and pays attention to you, and has not forgotten about you, nor will he ever, and nor will he ever abandon you. So it's, I think it's a very intimate picture that we're to have, to be the setting for our life having meaning. But obviously sometimes in life where some things happen to us, we're much more aware of that meaning than we are in others. I think of a story of my parents-in-law. This is just I give this as just a snapshot into a vast, something much more huge. They were, it's when they were in, I guess, their early 60s, this lady comes up to their door, they were living in Long Island, and she announces, I'm coming here because I want to thank you because you saved my life and gave me the life that I have. They didn't even recognize her. She started talking, and then slowly they recognized her. She grew up next door, her parents were alcoholics. She came and hung out at their home and was made very, very welcome in their home for years in her most vulnerable time as she grew up as a kid. She was a bit older than their children, so she was like, for Marty, she was sort of like an older sister. She was there in the family photographs. She was there as they went to pick up their father, who was at the airport, came back, throw them all in the back of the car, just totally informally a part of the picture. She comes back and says, it's only because of looking at your family that I dare to get married. I'm now married. I have two kids, a wonderful family, and so on. And I just look at this, and they were just totally blown away. They had no idea any of this is happening. Or even that having her in their home was anything particularly significant, even to her. They loved her. She was a lovely person to have around, etc. But looking at it then, having been surprised by this, they're getting a glimpse into a little picture of God's plan and God's use of them that they had no clue about. And all this was happening. She was going up, getting an education, getting married, having children, all these things, having a very full life that hinged on this time that she'd spent with them. They had no clue about this, but that had been a piece of the meaning of their life, the Wonder of Wonders they got to hear about later on. Most of the time we don't. People don't, they don't need to come back. They don't have to come back. We don't need to know, but it's sometimes nice to know. But I think there's all sorts of things like that happening that never come back to visit us, but that have to do with the meaning that God builds into our lives. Mr. Schaefer often asks, what do you suppose is the most important day of your life? And everyone puts their thinking cap on and wondering, what in the world should I say to this and how do I evaluate it? And she, you know, you get all sorts of things being said. But she then suggested that, you know, it probably is a day you don't even remember. Because what matters is what's the most important day in your life is what's the most important day in your life in God's view, and God's view. And it may well be a day that you don't even remember. Don't remember the date, don't remember where you were, don't remember what you did, don't remember who you were with. But you did something, you said something, you whatever, that in the wisdom of God was absolutely very important to him and to his unfolding of his plan. So I think we need that sort of humility. But we need that faith to know that, darn it, God is using us, and our lives have meanings many meanings in this way because they're in his service. So that's the way I try and come at it. Any other things? Things you'd like to raise? Well, it's been... Yes, go ahead.
I was thinking, I don't know if any of you are familiar with the musician Michael Card, but he was speaking on this topic, and he said something to the effect of imagination is the bridge between the heart and the mind. And I was reflecting on that and how beautiful that is, and perhaps that's why Jesus targeted the imagination through his parables, because he realized that connection and that both our heart and our mind need to be redeemed and set free by imitation of himself. And that perhaps when our imagination either becomes too overextended and too self-focused and fantasy, or if it becomes too prosaic and practical and not able even really to dive into the realms of wonder, then perhaps that's either becoming, it's breaking that bridge and is either varying too much towards the area of our heart or too much to the area of our mind. Does that seem like a reasonable thought?
It could well. I don't want to limit imagination at all, because both heart and mind need imagination itself, not just as a bridge between them.
Sure.
But it can function as a bridge between them as well. So it's an interesting idea. Yeah, I think that's it. Because it has all these functions, which are wild and wonderful, and hard to keep track of. But you try and sort of get a hold of it, and it squeezes out on you in every which other direction. So it's hard to kind of contain it. But that's the wonder of it all. But I'm sure it does. It would have that. Remind me of what C.S. Lewis in the Abolition of Man has the, talks about the way we have our heads, our thinking, and you know, our processing, our brain, and then we have our gut, which is our feeling, our sort of crude motivations and desires and drives and so on, and it's our chest that's between, which has to get our ideas to our process our gut feelings and interact between them. And I think he probably means something like heart or whatever. But he says we're producing men without chests, and so we just have heads and gut feelings, and we don't know what to do with either because they're separate from each other. And it's interesting. Unfortunately, it's just a very brief part of that book. I'd like to have him. I wish he'd spun it out more, because it would have been an interesting thing. So there's all sorts of ways we can formulate things like that, but it's I think that's helpful. Yeah, any other things? That's that. Yeah.
Just speaking of imagination as story, or stories yet working imagination, I saw an interesting quote, maybe you've heard. The guy said, literature was history with the truth left in.
Literature is history with the truth left in.
In other words, it could be fiction, but you leave out the fact, you leave out the fact, the cold facts and figures and measurements aren't the truth that you need to know.
Yeah. And
it's not all the time true. It's not
sure.
all the time true. But
yeah,
you talk,
sure.
It's not, but it's just a thought that you know, good literature might be totally fictitious, but the truth there has been left in that was not in the history book.
Mm-hmm. That's perfectly possible. That's certainly a true.
Or as you spoke, the way Jesus spoke with his imaginations. That's what, you know, the not using the precise words about our language, but thinking about tongue and butter and knives and that's not literally true.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not. I don't know what the word is. It's not factual.
There's a literalness that it doesn't follow. And yet, for most people who read the Bible in that way, it communicates all they need to know about the literal truth of this deal you've got inside your mind.
The truth left in, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, but much more, because you have with the tongue as a razor, you have something that's really dangerous and that can really hurt people badly. So you have a respect for something that you don't have if you just have the sort of literal technical words used. Yeah, well, anything else we'd like to raise? Otherwise, we can call it a night, because you've been up late enough already. So, come back to you tomorrow morning if you can.
I
have some free time. That's great.
I'm actually flying out to Israel next week to do some movie art. But I'll be back.
Is there a safe place to be now? Is it?
It's never a safe place to be.
That's where you go.
But I just wanted to, since we've been talking about you for so long.